Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 214, focusing with Dr. Ann Weiser Cornell. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
Sitting with people face to face, needing to give them something in an hour that was worth the money they were paying me, I needed to drastically evolve the way focusing had been given to me. I needed to adapt and change what we had been doing in Chicago so that it was more immediately helpful to people. And the first thing I learned was people need help to have the kind of the quality of attention toward themselves that focusing needs. That's what's not simple.
That was the voice of my guest, Dr. Ann Weiser Cornell, speaking about focusing. Ann Weiser Cornell, PhD, for more than 30 years, has been refining an approach to personal change that she calls inner relationship focusing. Ann was getting her PhD in linguistics at the University of Chicago when she met and worked with Dr. Eugene Gendlin, the originator of focusing, as one of his earliest students. After teaching linguistics at Purdue University, Ann returned to Chicago to assist Gendlin with his focusing workshops and eventually, with Gendlin's blessing, created her own approach to focusing. Today, Ann is perhaps the best-known focusing teacher in the world, having taught in 18 countries worldwide over the past 29 years. Eugene Gendlin says about Ann, "In person and through her students and writings, she has given focusing to far more people than any other single individual." Inner relationship focusing is based on the focusing process of Eugene Gendlin combined with Ann's facilitative language and her work with her colleague Barbara McGavin on action blocks, addictions, resistance, obsessions, and inner critics. Ann's own journey of personal growth has included recovery from severe writer's block and an addiction to alcohol. Ann is also the author of the best-selling book, The Power of Focusing, as well as another book, The Radical Acceptance of Everything. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Ann Weiser Cornell, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Well, over the past 5 years of this podcast, I've had several requests to do a show on focusing. And I believe it was Gary Goodwin, who I also met at an International Association for the Study of Dreams conference, who thought that you'd be especially good on this topic. So I've been chasing after you for some time, and you've been running around doing workshops, and you've been very busy. So I'm glad we can finally do the interview.
Well, I've been devoting my life, really, to focusing ever since I learned it from Eugene Gendlin, who developed it. And I have a good time teaching in different places in the world and really helping people learn this amazing skill.
Oh, yes. Well, that does sound enviable. As you mentioned, Eugene Gendlin, Dr. Eugene Gendlin, was the creator of focusing, and I had the opportunity to meet him once or twice, and I'll say more about that in my comments after our interview. Also, I seem to recall that I took a brief training workshop in the approach quite a while back from John Wellwood. Does that ring a bell for you? Do you know him?
I know John. I know just about everybody in the focusing world.
Okay, yeah. So I am remembering correctly that he was in the focusing world, or maybe still is.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, as they say, enough about me. Let's start out by having you tell our listeners what focusing is.
Well, focusing is a process of awareness of a funny kind of inner experience called a felt sense. So then we need to go on and ask what a felt sense is. And that's where it gets very interesting. Because when Gendlin first did the research that led to his developing a focusing, he noticed that certain psychotherapy clients were in contact moment by moment with something that they weren't easily able to put into words. And yet it was contact with this something that they could feel but not easily put into words that actually led to therapeutic change. So for him, this connects to his philosophy of what it is to be human, what change is, that our experience is richly textured, that just words like anger or sadness can't capture what we really are from moment to moment. And so a felt sense is the experience of an intricate, whole, more than I could say easily, how I am right now.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what focusing is. Focusing is attention to that.
You know, I hear crossovers to other approaches as I hear you describe it. I don't know if you're familiar with the work of Jim Bugenthal, who recently passed away, and he did something he called existential humanistic psychotherapy. And it was very much about, and I can't recall the term that he used, but it was very much about an inner felt sense.
Mm. I've heard of him, certainly. Mm-hmm. I haven't actually seen his work, so I don't know for sure. But I think what Jen Lund's point would be about the felt sense, we all have them, and any successful therapy helps people access them.
Yes, yes, and that's probably the commonality there. Yeah, tell us a little bit about Jen Lund's background. Was he trained in a certain tradition? What did he evolve out of to get into this focusing work?
Well, let me go all the way back to his childhood, because that's really an interesting source for this work. I don't know, many people may not realize he's a Holocaust survivor.
No, I certainly didn't know that.
Yeah. He was 11 years old when an Austrian Jewish family, the Nazis marched into Austria, and his father realized he had to get his family out. And when Jen Lund tells a story about those times, it's as exciting as a thriller. He keeps saying, as he watched his father make these difficult choices, who should I trust to help us survive and find a way out? He would see his father tapping his chest. He would say, Dad, how did you know not to trust that person? And his dad would tap his chest and say, something inside here knows.
Mm.
And so, yet at this really intensely stressful, dangerous time, that impressionable young boy got the message. How do people have an inner knowing that lets them know who to trust and who not to trust? How did his dad do that? So fast forward to his days as a philosophy student at the University of Chicago. He was fascinated by philosophy. But what he kept wondering was, how do people describe experiencing? And the kind of philosophy he was interested in was existential.
Yes.
Phenomenology.
Yes.
And Merleau-Ponty. So he heard the rumor that over in the psychology department, headed by Carl Rogers, who we've all heard of, they were describing people's experiences. So as he tells it, he sneaked in, pretended to be a client so he could pick up some of the study papers that were lying around, and soon after that became a real client of Carl Rogers. And soon after that, became, you know, he didn't stop being a philosophy student, but he became a psychology student as well. And so he was a student, a client of Carl Rogers, and later a close colleague.
Oh, I didn't know that background. That's very interesting. And it's not surprising to hear that sort of existential, humanistic, philosophical background, because that would be sort of the commonality with, as you say, Rogers and Bugenthal and some of the other approaches where I'm sensing that resonance. For example, Gestalt therapy, back when I read Jindlin's 1982 book, which I think was titled Focusing, I had the impression that there was a lot in common with Gestalt therapy because of the emphasis on immediacy, the here and now, and paying attention to what's going on in one's body.
Definitely, yeah.
And how it changes from moment to moment. But it sounds like Jindlin came up with a very similar idea, but also independently.
Mm-hmm. Well, you need to have that kind of philosophical background, and even maybe that Holocaust background. He's really an amazing and unique person. I don't think anyone else has exactly described the felt sense. With the philosophical concept that so much of our experiencing is implicit until it's described. And it's quite different from Freud's view, which is still very common in our popular culture, which is that we have kind of buried or stored our emotional experience. Jindlin says, no, we don't have a storage model. We don't have repressed anger or buried sadness. Instead, those experiences are implicit. They're unfinished. They've been, you know, pathology is a sort of, well, he literally says pathology is the lack of a further experiencing. That experiencing has been stopped somehow. And then in the presence of a therapeutic other, that experiencing can begin to resume again. So, yes, the commonalities are there. And I think no one else quite has that felt sense, which is this rich, intricate, implicit experiencing that can be tapped into.
Mm-hmm. What about all the emphasis these days on mindfulness? That seems to me to be another place of potential crossover.
I'm excited to see so much emphasis on mindfulness. I think that focusing and mindfulness walk quite a long ways down the same path together.
Mm-hmm.
But I've heard people say focusing is mindfulness, and I think those people may not understand the concept of the felt sense, that it's not simply awareness of whatever is here. It's awareness of a very particular formation, the felt sense of a situation that has intricacy to it, and then symbolizing that. And mindfulness doesn't go into that. The importance of symbolization as a carrying forward of implicit experiencing.
What do you mean by symbolization?
Well, I mean something as simple as putting it into words.
Okay.
Or finding an image for it. So when I'm in contact with my felt sense, I then stay with my awareness of it and begin to put it into words. In one famous story of a client, Jindlin describes his client who comes into the office, you know, why don't I get a good relationship? Why don't I hand in my papers? And he helps her to get the fresh right now sense of it, and the words are, I pull back. And no other words quite fit. That's it. That brings a kind of relief. I pull back. And then by then inviting her to sit with the pullback, as he calls it, he makes it into a the pullback, she's then able to get a big step of change. It reveals itself to be a part of her that's been in hiding, not wanting to be crushed by being brought out into the open. So the symbolizing dances with the sensing. The person who's focusing senses and then symbolizes and then checks the symbolizing back with the felt experience, and that carries the whole process forward.
Okay. Are there particular conditions that focusing is especially good for?
No. I'm going to say focusing.
Good for everything?
I would say, yeah. You know, focusing, let me just come right in here and say focusing is a human process. You can, within the therapeutic context, it's a client process. So it isn't something a therapist does to a client. It's not even a technique or a method. The method would be called focusing-oriented therapy. But focusing itself has been found in every culture. When you study therapy tapes of every kind of therapy, you can hear the clients doing focusing naturally. So humans have focusing. Now, there are certainly people who may be in therapy, who may be at a stage where being invited to do focusing won't be, they wouldn't be ready for that. They wouldn't feel safe enough. It wouldn't be the right moment in the process for them to do it. But that's something that we can't categorize by, okay, a certain type of person or a certain diagnosis shouldn't do it. No, it's something that can be sensed in the interactional space.
Something that I've heard and would like your impression about is that focusing is good as an adjunctive tool, but it's not really a complete psychotherapy in itself. So it's something
I think that's right. I think that's just what I was trying to point to there. Focusing isn't even a technique at all. So facilitating focusing in the client would be one thing that a therapist would include in a repertoire. And yet there's also a way of doing any therapeutic method, any modality, in a focusing-oriented way. You can do focusing-oriented cognitive behavioral therapy. Mm-hmm. You know, you can do focusing-oriented psychoanalytical therapy by making sure that each move you make, you've then invited the person to check what they're experiencing with that and sense what kind of felt impact that makes. So, you know, you can say focusing is more like water. It's essential to life, but you don't make a meal of it.
Okay, that's a good metaphor. So it's not a whole system in and of itself, and yet there's enough to it that you do workshops and trainings in it for many years now.
Well, yes. So my workshops are to teach people focusing as a method for them to use for themselves.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I work with therapists as well, and when I do, I invite therapists to first learn focusing for themselves. And we teach also something called focusing-oriented therapy, and what we say is to do focusing-oriented therapy, first of all, the therapist is focusing. So if when you're sitting across from a client, you have your own felt sense, and you're not just relying on, I mean, who would do this, right? You're not just relying on textbooks and formulas and techniques, you're there present as a whole person with the client. Well, learning focusing as a method for oneself helps you do that.
Sure. Sure. It seems like the ability to be really present in the therapeutic session, really present with yourself and therefore, and somehow therefore at the same time really present for that other person, really means a lot.
Of course. And we know that to be true, and we are often advised or told to do that. I help people with the how to do that.
Yeah, it sounds so easy to say, be a good listener.
That's right.
And in practice, it's so hard. I mean, it can be very challenging. So I think if to some people, it just comes very naturally.
Right.
But certainly
they
not
can't
to
describe very well what they're doing.
Yeah, certainly not to all of us. It doesn't come that
That's
easily.
Right. That's right. And so many of the things that we're advised to do, you know, be a good listener, be present, accept yourself. I feel like in the focusing world, we've developed specific how to do that. We can show you step by step.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe we can go through some of those steps as we go along here. I know that in your work, you've kind of evolved focusing over time. You've even got a recent book called The Radical Acceptance of Everything. Maybe before we talk about the book, say a little bit about, you know, what the elements you've introduced into the mix in the process of evolving focusing.
Well, what struck me immediately when I first learned it, which was 37 years ago, it wasn't so easy for me to do. I think that ultimately made me a very a good teacher of it.
Sure, because you had to break it down and understand it.
I wasn't one of those natural focuses.
Yeah.
The fact that I had to struggle to learn it gave me a lot of insight
exactly.
into what people needed in order to learn it.
Yes.
And by the way, I wasn't studying to be a therapist. I was a student of linguistics when I first encountered Jen Lahn at the University of Chicago at a free community meeting. And learned focusing only for myself. No one thought there would be such a profession as focusing teacher.
Hmm.
So who knew where that would ever lead? So
yeah.
I was really wanting self-awareness. I wanted freedom from the suffering of being 22 years old and having come from a dysfunctional alcoholic family and never having done any introspection before. And it was amazing what focusing did for me even back then. And
maybe you could say a little bit more
yeah.
about that. Yes, to say a little bit about
okay.
how that process worked for you.
Okay, and first I should probably say that what Jen Lahn was teaching in this community meeting was for people to be peer counselors. So we learned how to be focusing partners.
Yes.
I never worked with him directly. He taught the group, and then we practiced with each other. And so it's also a model of community healing, that people can do this in pairs with each other,
mm-hmm.
and that's how I teach it to this day.
Okay.
So here I was, 22 years old, practicing, exchanging the skills of focusing and empathic listening, 8 hours a week, with 4 different focusing partners every week, and encountering myself, discovering I had a self, I had insides. My background up to that time, living in a dysfunctional alcoholic family in the Midwest, where denial is the way of life, you know. I could tell you how everybody else was feeling in a room and had no clue about how I felt.
Yes.
So it was a journey of discovery, and it was a self-guided journey of discovery. My friends were there simply saying back to me what they heard me say, and it was gorgeous. It was intense. It was hard. But I ultimately, step by step, got myself back. I could tell you how I felt.
Mm-hmm.
I got closer and closer to being able to tell how I felt moment to moment.
Mm-hmm.
It took months. I remember when I got up to being able to tell what I had felt 2 hours before.
Well, that's true for a lot of us, that we don't know till later, you know, when we're brushing our teeth. I should have said such and such.
That's right. Or, ouch, that hurt what she said, and I just smiled at the time, you
yes.
know. And so I love being current with myself.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the gifts focusing gave me almost immediately.
Mm-hmm.
Within the first year, focusing has given me the gift of being able to help me make decisions that were right for me rather than being the logical thing to do or society's right thing to do. For example, I was supposed to be a linguistics teacher. I got a PhD in linguistics. I got fellowships where I promised I would be a teacher. But I already had focusing by the time I started teaching linguistics, and I could tell that it felt wrong. And very quickly got out of there without knowing what I was going to do instead, took the leap because I could trust that inner sense of wrongness and rightness
mm-hmm.
that focusing had enabled me to have.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
That's great.
So where were we? I was telling you about how I've evolved. Yeah?
Yeah, yeah. And we were going to talk about, or are talking about, how focusing has evolved under your care.
Right, right. So since I'm telling you my life story, I'll tell you the next step, which I left teaching linguistics, and by that time, Jen Lahn's book had been published, and he invited me to teach with him.
Uh-huh. That must have been
wonderful. So that's
wonderful.
When the profession of focusing teaching began, as his book got more and more popular, and people kept calling him from all over the world to say, well, when's your next workshop? And we'd be giving these workshops every few months. And then I moved to California in 1983, thinking, oh no, I'm leaving the center of the world for focusing, which was Chicago at that time. But actually, it was the best thing that could have happened for me. I wanted to be an independent focusing teacher in California. I put my ads in Open Exchange and Common Ground, and people started showing up. And I had been a therapist in Illinois, but I didn't want to be a therapist in California. I wanted to be simply a focusing teacher. But sitting with people face-to-face, needing to give them something in an hour that was worth the money they were paying me, I needed to drastically evolve the way focusing had been given to me. I needed to adapt and change what we had been doing in Chicago so that it was more immediately helpful to people. And the first thing I learned was people need help to have the kind of the quality of attention toward themselves that focusing needs. That's what's not simple. So focusing needs us to be non-judgmental, accepting, a kind of curious, open, aware attitude. Well, we can't even do the simple sensing and describing that focusing needs. So we need it almost like some pre-focusing. Because so many people, as we know, are not in that state with their own experiencing at all. Instead, people are evaluating how they feel. We're judging how we feel. We're trying to fix how we feel. And that led me to understand that what I needed to concentrate on with people was their quality of relationship with them, their own inner experience. And I began to call it inner relationship. So what can I do to help people move into a relationship with themselves that's non-judgmental, accepting, open, and curious.
Yes, yes. That makes a lot of sense to me.
It does. And that really is what became my main focus. And I evolved a kind of language that people can use themselves that enables them to move into that state. I began calling it the state of presence. Presence being the ability to be with whatever arises in you. And you can be in presence or you can be out of presence.
Yes.
Out of presence is identification with a part of ourselves. So if I'm identified with emotional experience, if I'm saying things like, I'm angry or I hate this feeling, then I'm not going to be able to get to focusing from there unless I get some help or I help myself to disidentify. To say, something in me is angry, or something in me doesn't like this feeling. And then that little shift is actually huge in the inner world.
Now, it sounds like this might lead into your book, which you call The Radical Acceptance of Everything.
Exactly. Now we see where that title ties in.
Yeah. You know, so the question arises, how does one accept everything?
Exactly. How does one accept everything? Mm-hmm. Well, and just to be sure we understand each other and people understand what I mean by accepting everything, I'm not talking about accepting everything that happens in the outer world. That would not be my department.
Mm-hmm.
But if we just look at the inner world, the radical acceptance of everything that arises in us, so our thoughts, our feelings, our emotions, our reactions, that can be done. And it's the fastest way to transformation. And what I see as really tragic is that people get locked into the attempt to change themselves by disrespecting themselves, by not accepting. I can't accept that because it's got to change, that type of attitude. I can't, mm-hmm. I work a lot now with people who have what I call action blocks, can't get my paper written, can't get myself to get my resume polished up to send out for a new job, that sort of thing.
Right.
And it turns out there, you can invite the part of you that's not getting the paper written, the part of you that's not wanting to get the resume polished. And if you do focusing with that, get a felt sense of it, get interested in it, let it tell its story, transformation happens. Life starts to move. The blocked, stuck places start to open up. But so often what I need to help people do first is turn toward the other part of them, the one that's anxious, urgent, worried. I can't accept that. I can't be nice to that. I can't listen to that because it is my enemy. And what I've discovered through working with this material over 37 years, if you count the years in which I worked with myself, there are no enemies inside. There is nothing in us, in each of us, that's trying to hurt us. Everything's trying to save our life.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even believe in the concept of self-sabotage, because if you say it that way, it sounds like there's a part of you trying to hurt you. People will say, I'm sabotaging myself. They're not. What's going on is...
How do you account for the stuff that looks like that?
Well, thanks for that great question. Let me take my own example, because I used focusing to release a really severe... I use my brand of focusing, which I call inner relationship focusing, to release a really severe writer's block. And partly what I mean by severe is that I yearned to write, I longed to write, that I felt like it was my destiny to write, and I just couldn't.
Oh, I've been there. I can relate to that.
And you can agree, can't you, that it's really painful.
Oh, yes.
To feel like what's right in front of you, your very path to your life fulfillment, is exactly what you can't do. And no wonder in our frustration with such a situation, concepts like self-sabotage come up. But so the story was that I sat down to do focusing with this issue and invited the part of me that didn't want to write. Not being in touch with it at that moment, but just kind of by inference, since I long to write and am not writing, there must be a part of me that doesn't want to write. I didn't know what was going to happen. But in response to my invitation, and I'm also sensing in my body at this point, because that's where we get these felt senses, I began to feel something. The part of me that doesn't want to write was showing up in my body at that moment as a kind of constriction. And notice it's not so easy to describe. I can't be glib in what was being found there. Felt it, but I couldn't easily describe it. That's what felt senses are like. So there, maybe in the chest, something like a pulling forward or a constriction, and I stayed with it. And as I stayed with it, more began to come. It showed me it wasn't just constriction. It was like ducking. It was trying to pull my body over into a kind of ducking motion. And as I stayed with that, I began to get the image of a target range. And it was as if this place inside me that didn't want me to write felt I was on a target. I was on a shooting range down by the targets.
Oh, yes.
And was trying to pull me over to duck. And this was all new to me. I didn't know any of this. So I stayed with it, you know, with this attitude of interested acceptance. And then it started showing me memories of what it had been like to live with my sarcastic father.
Mm-hmm.
That was like being shot at.
Mm-hmm.
And I then, in the process of inner relationship focusing, we then really let it know we hear it. So I said, oh, I really see, I hear what you're showing me. Oh, no wonder. No wonder is also a great phrase I like to use. No wonder you've been stopping me from writing, if that's what you don't want to have happen to me again. And I felt a release in my body when I did that. The constriction released. There was a fresh, warm flow of energy in the place where it had been. And writing was easier. Now, I won't say one session changed everything. I had a number of sessions about such a entrenched issue as that one, but it was part of the answer. And I'm telling you that story now to give you an example of what we mean when we say something can look like self-sabotage. From the outside, we can be mystified. Why? I want to write. I know my destiny is to write. Every good thing would come from writing. Why would something in me not want to? And then it turns out there is a part that believes that will lead to something that will hurt you.
Yeah, that's a great illustration.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I could know the answer. I could know intellectually, it's because it doesn't want me to be criticized.
Mm-hmm.
But it's different when you do it from the inside as a freshly encountered felt experience, then something really shifts.
Yeah, that's a subtle but important distinction, isn't it?
Mm. Uh-huh.
Yeah, I'm struck by the fact that you were able to do that work with yourself. I know sometimes I find it difficult to do that sort of a process with myself, by myself. It seems to help me to have somebody else there who's going to keep me. It's hard to avoid using the word focused all the time, but that's going to keep me focused or directed.
Well, I'm really happy you noticed what was missing in my story. The truth is there was somebody else there. And just to keep it simple, I didn't mention that. That was a focusing partner.
Mm-hmm.
So that other person wasn't making suggestions, wasn't giving me input. That other person was simply reflecting back to me my experiencing and helping create a safe space for me to do that work. And believe me, it would have been pretty much impossible for me to do it without another person there. Another person really adds something very important.
Yeah, somehow it helps to keep you on the dime.
It does.
Yeah.
The presence of another person is magical, very, very, very empowering. As long as that person isn't, interfering, bringing in something from outside the mix in a way that you can feel isn't helpful.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, sometimes it feels good to get some kind of input, an opinion, or what would you do? But then we need time to take that inside and check if it fits. So they need to not be doing that too much. And so it's the focuser, the person doing the focusing, their own experiencing, that's the check on that.
Okay. Well, you've just given us a good illustration of working with one of your own, what you call action blocks. And okay. I notice you also describe yourself as working with addictions, resistance, obsessions, inner critics.
That's right.
Do you want to say something about those other sorts of issues?
Well, they all have something important in common.
Uh-huh.
In fact, you can see addictions as the inverse of action blocks. So an action block is when there's something that you'd like to be doing, but you're not doing it. And an addiction is when there's something you'd like to stop doing, but you're not stopping it.
Yes, okay.
So they're both about action, really.
Mm.
Either blocked action or, you could say, out of control action. And I certainly have my own history with addiction as well. So one of the real sources of my more recent work with inner relationship focusing is my own recovery from addiction to alcohol. And understanding that what had been happening when I was in the tangle of drinking addictively and then arguing with myself and trying to stop it, but then doing it and not saying I shouldn't do it. I was caught up in identification with these different parts of me. What wasn't there in that tangle or that inner struggle was the sense of me as a whole self, what my colleague Barbara McGavin and I call self in presence. So self in presence needed to show up. And it was through realizing I'd been using alcohol addictively, stopping, and then trying to understand what had happened, that Barbara McGavin and I began really to develop the part of our work that is where we work with some of the most difficult areas that people face.
Well, addictions are notoriously difficult.
Addictions are very difficult, and one that we even find more difficult is something we call unfulfilled desire. Longing. But definitely addictions are difficult. And so the part that wants to do the action, the part that wants to do the behavior, the part that's trying to stop it, and then self in presence, neither one of those, not getting identified with, not becoming one part or the other, because within the tangle, within the struggle, there is no way out. That's a self, that's a closed system. We need to step out of that closed system and be the self that can hold that whole system, the different parts that are involved, with curiosity. And yes, that's then when focusing can begin.
I like your use of the word tangle, you know, instead of neurosis or pathology or some other heavily loaded word. Somehow, tangle really captures it in a nice and non-judgmental way.
Thank you. Yeah, we're trying to use that kind of vivid language that doesn't make assumptions. Exactly.
Yeah.
We start with a tangle.
Do you have some other great words that you use?
Probably.
Because I noticed in one place you talk about something you call facilitative language.
And
with your background as a linguist, what do you mean by facilitative language?
Oh, yes. Well, the facilitative language, it shows that we can shift our own experiencing just by shifting the language that we use. And in particular, we have something we call presence language, where you use 5 words that change the experience of being identified with a part of us to the experience of being able to be with that. And that begins to make focusing possible. When we're identified, we can't do focusing. That's what I was discovering when I first worked with it independently. The presence language, 5 words: I'm sensing something in me. So we start with a phrase like, I'm angry. I'm angry at her. And then shift to, I'm sensing something in me is angry at her. Notice what happens. Take in the emotional sentence like that. I'm sad about it. I'm worried. I'm tired. Those are sentences spoken from an identified position.
And so you're kind of frozen in that position.
You're frozen in that position. It's what we call identified or merged with the part of us that has those emotions. And it feels at that moment like that's all of you. That's what emotions do. They narrow our focus. They're meant to do that. From an evolutionary stance, having an emotion like anger, you need to narrow your focus so you can fight or flee or whatever you need to do. So, but it isn't helpful to stay in an emotional position if what you want to do is understand what's going on and be able to communicate about it to the people involved. So how do we step back from emotional identification into being with that part of us that has the emotion? You see, when I was growing up in the Midwest, we had only 2 ways to be with emotional experience. Our favorite way was denial, which was, no, sweetie, I'm not angry. My mother.
Yeah.
No, sweetie, I'm not angry with you. I'm just terribly disappointed.
I can hear your mother in there.
And in the child's body, you know that's a lie, but it's very confusing because you're never going to get them to know it Anyway, so identification with an emotion is a narrow experience. It's a partial experience. What we need is to step back away from identification, but not through denial of it. We stay in presence with the emotional experience and yet identify with something larger than that. So that's why we call this presence language. So not I'm angry, but I'm sensing something in me is angry.
Mm-hmm.
And when you do that, you begin to be able to feel it. This is something I do in my classes. I invite people to start with a sentence that is an identified language. I'm angry, I'm upset, I'm bored, I'm tired, something they feel at the moment or they've recently felt, and then shift to, I'm sensing something in me is bored or tired or worried or, and notice what happens when you just change your language. I'm sensing something in me is a bit nervous. And, right? And what often happens is you get introspective at that moment. Instead of being caught up in something and ready to act out of it, you turn toward it. Oh, and you start to get curious. This is a huge shift, one that enables us to access more of our available intelligence. It enables us to meet others in a way that makes them more likely to be open to us. But feel the difference between I'm angry at you and, you know, I'm sensing something in me is angry at you.
Mm-hmm.
So we our relationships get better. Plus, we've taken the first step toward a process of self-awareness. Well, I'm sensing something in me is angry. Well, actually, now that I say that much, it's not so much angry, it's more like, and then there's an evolutionary process. Emotions evolve. Once you start by sensing how you feel what we call self in presence, from a larger perspective, the emotions evolve. I think a lot of the ways people speak about emotions these days assumes they're not going to change.
Mm-hmm.
Emotions, they're spoken of like furniture. I need to get over that anger or get around that sadness or get through that, you know, instead of treating them like emotion, something that is processed, something that will change when you spend time with it.
Interesting. In some ways, it sounds like Buddhist meditation, where you're invited to watch your feelings come and go and change, but without judgment and without attachment. But you're adding something extra, which is some intention to do something about it somehow.
There's an intention to get to know it better.
Okay.
I think that's and as we were saying earlier about mindfulness, the process of inner relationship focusing walks down the path quite a long way with Buddhist meditation, especially what's called Vipassana, or
yes,
mindfulness meditation, where you are noticing body awareness as part of what you're noticing arise and fall. But with focusing, you're staying engaged. There's a relationship there, a relationship of curiosity and interest. It's more personal, more intrapersonal, more personal in an inner way. And so there's an exploration, there's a getting to know better. And with Janlin's original concept of what a felt sense is, we understand that once you have interested contact with what you're feeling, it always evolves. There's no such thing as feelings being like objects. They are always in a process of evolution when we bring awareness to them in this non-judgmental way. When our feelings seem to stay the same year after year, it's because they haven't had an open non-judgmental awareness brought to them in this way that we're talking about.
Now, I seem to recall from Jinlin's book that part of his process was to also have an image emerge, almost like a visual image that somehow captures the essence of the feeling. And an example of that in the story that you told was the target.
Yes.
And is that still a part of your work?
Oh, yes. You know, that's what we call symbolization. But what is interesting to me is that, well, you can really trust the process to bring that. You know, there's no need to invite specifically an image or words or one or the other. You're just open to the way it wants to express itself. People are delightfully different that way. Some get lots of images very easily. They kind of need to be slowed down a bit and brought into the body. Others are quite verbal, but their words help them stay with something that they're feeling. Others have long periods of silence where they're simply aware of something quite kinesthetic. So in terms of the different modes of processing, visual, auditory, kinesthetic, and so on, focusing crosses over all of those. It's possible to do it in all those ways.
Well, this has really been fascinating, and we're coming to the place where I think we need to begin to wind down. What's your recommendation to any current or would-be therapists who might wish training in focusing?
Well, I give training in focusing to therapists.
Oh, my goodness.
Have a look at my website.
Right, and I'll put a link to your website. You might want to mention it right now. What is the address?
FocusingResources.com.
Okay, that's easy.
Yeah.
And what about recommendations for listeners who might wish to explore focusing as a client? I suppose one would be to read your book.
Well, yeah, and people who might want to visit FocusingResources.com, my website, they'll see four portals or doorways. One is for therapists in particular, and we have some great programs for therapists. One is for people interested in exploring getting unblocked or working with, I'm forgetting my own website. Anyway, there are doorways for individuals to explore focusing. There's doorways for therapists to explore focusing. And my book, The Power of Focusing, still in print, still available. The new one is The Radical Acceptance of Everything.
You really did get over that block, didn't you? You wrote not one book, but two.
I write all the time now. It's completely gone.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah. So you'll also on the website, there'll be free resources, some free calls that we did where you can we take you through some processes. A lot of articles are there. I have a free e-zine, an e-newsletter that if you want to hear a tidbit from me once a week, you can sign up for that.
Okay.
So
well,
we welcome
great.
People's interest, yeah.
Yeah, good. Well, is there anything that you'd like to say as we wrap up? Any last word?
Well, I think that what I've gathered from my journey with focusing over 37 years is that we can trust our own inner knowing. And what I love about my work is that I help people come to the trust their
mm-hmm.
inner knowing.
Mm-hmm.
So much of our culture has taken us away from ourselves and draws our attention out into outer authority and takes us away from trusting ourselves. So let's come back. Let's come back to our birthright of trusting the inner knowing inside ourselves.
Well, Dr. Ann Weiser-Cornell, it's been delightful speaking with you, and thank you so much for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thanks. It's been a pleasure.
I hope you enjoyed this chat with Dr. Ann Weiser-Cornell. We've not met in person, even though she's located in the San Francisco Bay Area. Due to our relative proximity and similarity of interests, I suspect there are a number of people that we know in common, though. I especially appreciate listener Gary Goodwin alerting me to her work. Well, I was a big fan of Dr. Eugene Ginlan before he ever wrote about focusing. And the reason I was a fan is that for many years he was the editor of a journal called Psychotherapy, the Art and Science of Therapy, and it was one of the few professional journals I found worth reading. I think it was actually an APA journal, and those are usually quite formal and stuffy. At a time when psychology was still being very narrow-minded, the journal Psychotherapy was a very eclectic journal under Jenlin's leadership, and it featured articles on a wide variety of approaches, and I seem to recall it even permitted the use of the word I and some sharing from a subjective point of view, which made it particularly attractive to me. And in fact, I thought it felt like the kind of place I might publish someday, and in fact, that came to pass. As I recall, I first learned of focusing in an article or two that he published there, and it was only later that he published a book with the title Focusing. He was a professor at the very prestigious University of Chicago. I was pleased to have the opportunity to meet him once or twice. I think one of my colleagues brought him to Sonoma State University for a presentation. I remember him as a rather graceful and genteel man. And Anne informs me that Dr. Jenlin is alive and well and thriving in his 80s.
That's right. Shrink Wrap Radio. Coming at you now. Yo, everybody, let's get down. There's a new MC in town. Talking psychology interviews. Dr. Dave is all the rave. Ain't no slouch on the digital couch. He's on the pod. Podcast got the pod. Yeah. You want to be in the know? No. Talking Shrink Wrap Radio. Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. I'm talking Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. I'm talking Shrink Wrap Radio. Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. All right.
Hey, everybody. How are you doing? I'm feeling healthy and relaxed, having just returned from a weekend visit to Seattle. Perhaps you recall Shrink Wrap Radio number 162, Tea and Empathy, combining acupuncture, hypnosis, and NLP, with listener and guest Randy Clare. That was back in July of 2008, almost exactly a year ago. Well, Randy had issued a very warm invitation for me to come up and visit him and his lady Deb way back then. His invitation was so enthusiastic and genuine that I resolved to take him up on it. I had really meant to do it a lot sooner than this, but finally there was the space in my life to take him up on it. I really bonded with Randy and Deb. They were wonderful hosts, showing me the best of Seattle. Randy gave me acupuncture / moxibustion treatments, and we had long discussions about NLP. We did hypnosis with each other. I gave Randy and Deb tarot readings, and Deb led me through a wonderful Hawaiian shamanic healing ritual. Randy and I are exploring conducting some workshops together in which I'd blend my hero's journey tarot hypnotic gestalt work with his martial arts, oriental medicine, NLP, hypnotherapy skills. I know we'd have fun working together, and I think we could provide a valuable growth experience for the participants. Does this sound like something that you'd like? By the way, I took both still photos and short video clips on this trip with my iPhone. You can see the stills at www.flickr.com/Van Nuys D. And Flickr, of course, is spelled F-L-I-C-K-R. Or you can see the videos at www.youtube.com/Van Nuys D. So let me publicly thank and salute Randy and Deb for being such wonderful hosts. What a wonderful audience I do have. I also felt inspired during this trip to make a series of hypnosis recordings focusing on various personal growth themes for you listeners to download at a nominal fee. Now, I haven't actually made these recordings yet. Let me know if that sounds like something you'd be interested in. Now, speaking of downloading things from the Shrink Wrap Radio website, I got an email from listener Leanne that she took the survey and received the link to the bonus Dream Talk that I make available to those who take the Shrink Wrap Radio Survey on our site, but she was only able to hear the first 20 minutes of the hour-long talk. I'm wondering if anybody else had that problem. I have no idea how long this has been an issue. At any rate, the problem is fixed, and if you didn't hear the whole hour-long talk that I gave some years back at the University of New Hampshire when I was a visiting professor there, then you should dig up that old email link and go to the site again. If you did complete the survey but can't find the link you were sent, send me an email and I'll point you to it. There is a very important interview on my Wise Counsel podcast series right now, and I think you'll want to listen to it if you haven't already. It's an interview with David Wallen, PhD, on the implications of attachment theory for psychotherapy. I seem to recall that he was actually suggested to me by a Shrink Wrap Radio listener. He's written a marvelous book that really breaks down attachment theory in the clearest possible way. Hello to Kathleen in Hamilton, New Jersey, who says, "Great show. I look forward to every update." Well, that was on our Frapper map. If you haven't done so already, please add yourself to our Frapper map. You'll find a link on our site, or you can simply go to frappr.com/shrinkwrapradio. Don't forget to check out our Top Spots widget over on the right-hand side of the Shrink Wrap Radio page. If you haven't visited the site in a while, you should definitely take a look at it. This is a place where listeners can post an ad for services or their podcast or blog for a mere $20 PayPal payment. And that ad will stay up for months and months. It's got to be some of the cheapest advertising you can find anywhere on the internet. So either consider posting your own ad or patronizing one of our listeners who've posted theirs. For example, the most recent one listed in the top spot is from longtime listener Al Tabor, and he's advertising his vacation rental in Inverness, California. So this is a great opportunity for the summer especially, and summer is running out on us. If you don't know where Inverness is, it's a beautiful coastal woodsy resort area a bit north of San Francisco with lots of hiking trails and access to many nearby beaches, plus easy access to San Francisco. And so contact Al and be sure to let him know that you found out about it on Shrink Wrap Radio, and he'll probably offer you a great deal. And don't forget our Yahoo discussion group, You Are Invited. There's a banner link on our website in the right-hand gutter area, or you can simply send an email to shrinkwrapradio-subscribe@yahoogroups.com. Thank you so much for your donations, and if you haven't made a donation, please consider doing so. You'll find a big green donate button over on the right-hand side of the site. You know, you get 5 years' worth of content here, complete with over 100 transcripts. So go ahead and click on that big green donate button. And of course, I also appreciate your patronage of our sponsors using the discount links on our site for GoDaddy, PetMeds.com, Brookstone, Budget Car Rentals, Avis Car Rentals, and our newest sponsor, Angie's List.
Greetings. This is Randy Clare, practitioner of Oriental Medicine, Hypnotherapy, and NLP here in Seattle. You're on the couch with Dr. Dave. Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thanks, Randy. If any of you listeners are in the Seattle area, I highly recommend Randy Clare for acupuncture, NLP, and or hypnotherapy. In my visit this past weekend, I found him to be extremely knowledgeable and trustworthy. Now let's catch up with some listener email. First, we hear from Sean, who writes, "Dear Dave, I discovered your podcasts only recently and must say how much I have enjoyed listening. Particularly fascinating was a talk with Dean Radin on the subject of the paranormal, which is a great interest of mine. Anyway, would just like to make a suggestion for a future show. I was listening this evening to a talk on the subject of the highly sensitive person. It's estimated that 20% of the U.S. population, well over 50 million people, suffer with this condition, which is largely unrecognized. I wonder whether perhaps I fall into this category. The talk was hosted by Dr. Laura Honus-Webb, and her guest was Dr. Ted Zeff, Ph.D., who's based in the San Francisco Bay Area. He's written a number of books, including The Highly Sensitive Person's Survival Guide, and produced CDs on the subject. Hope it will be of great interest, Dave. Best wishes, Sean. Well, Sean, it must be you that I got the idea from, because Shrink Wrap Radio number 213, in fact, featured Dr. Ted Zeff on The Highly Sensitive Person, and I certainly hope you are on hand to hear that. Next, we hear from Nir in New York City, who provides our theme music for this show. He writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave. I just listened to the interview with Dr. David Burns. I just had to stop the car and write to you. His idea that it's the criticizing of the other one that causes problems in relationships is, in my opinion, so true and so to the point that it basically sums up much of the subject of psychology. There's a famous saying in the Jewish tradition that has no exact translation, but if I tried to translate it, it would be criticize others and reveal yourself." Ah, that's great. This is major, and all psychological work is and should be around this. The purpose of marriage is to facilitate and encourage this kind of work, where each individual should work on his or her own issues that are revealed through the relationship and the initial attempts to criticize the other as a defense. That's why couples therapy is great for individuals to work on themselves, which is the goal, but not necessarily helping the marriage, which is only a tool, but not the goal itself. I have to get back to driving, so thanks for another great program. Keep in touch. Best regards, Nir. Good point, Nir. Yes, it's all about projection and owning our projections. Next, we hear more praise for guest Dr. Dana Houck. "Hi, Dr. Dave. I just wanted to tell you I really enjoyed your interview with Dana Houck. I bought his book from Amazon and am really enjoying it. I've been working with someone in Portland, Oregon that I think you might be interested in. His name is Darren Littlejohn, and he wrote a great book called The 12-Step Buddhist. There's a small, growing movement in the 12-step world, mixing Buddhism with recovery work. His website is the12stepbuddhist.com. Thanks for all your great interviews. Best wishes, Tracy." Tracy, that is a great suggestion, and I need to make a note to myself to follow up on it. I would really like to do that. I get so many good suggestions from listeners that it's hard to honor them all, but that one strikes a particularly good note to me. The next one is from Cody in Israel, who writes in part, "Hi, Dave, I'm writing to you a separate email just about the wonderful show you have on Wise Counsel. Your interview with Becky LaFountain, Ph.D. on Adlerian psychology and psychotherapy, was wonderful. It brought back nice memories. I remembered how excited my husband was when our kids were small, and he went and took a course about child upbringing that was given by the Adler Institute here in our city. My husband was very satisfied with that course. According to his words, it gave him the confidence that he can treat kids properly. I haven't read much about Adler's works, and it was a very nice surprise to hear on your show that he was on so many fields a wonderful pioneer. I found your show a great tribute to Adler. Take care, Cody." And of course, that show was a great learning experience for me because I didn't know all that much about Adler, and I learned quite a bit in the interview. The next one comes all the way from Ireland. "Hello, Dr. Dave. Just a quick note that your podcast show on Shrink Wrap Radio is extremely enjoyable. I'm a civil engineer and have no prior knowledge of psychology, but I find the talks very accessible and interesting. I love all the stuff by Joe Campbell, and having read a number of his books and listened to the major video series, etc., I wonder where to go next with this interest. Do you know of any college or program that teaches courses about the works of Joseph Campbell and mythology, not to become a psychologist, but just for fun? I'm from Cork, Ireland, by the way. All the best, Des." Well, Des, I have fond memories of the time that I spent in Cork. Several nights, as I recall, several days and nights a few years back. And as for the coursework, gee, probably looking on the internet is the best way to do it. The courses that I know about are, in fact, tend to be doctoral level courses. And I think you'd have to be interested in becoming a psychologist, maybe to enroll in those. But I wouldn't be surprised if perhaps there were some online offerings that you could find through an online search, or maybe even some courses there in Ireland. Somewhat closer to home, we hear from Portland, Oregon, again, actually. Hey, Dr. Dave, many thanks to you for your time, energy, and fabulous product. I stumbled upon you after being introduced to process-oriented psychology and the works of Dr. Max Schuppbach and Dr. Arnold Mindell by one of my college professors. I was searching for information on process work, world work, on iTunes, and your podcast appeared. Not only have I listened to your interviews with the Mindells, Schuppbach, and Julie Diamond, I've been turned on to new ideas, philosophies, and learning opportunities. I'm grateful and thankful that I found my way to this resource. Looking forward to hearing more. And that's from Kristen in Portland, Oregon. Boy, those were all three of those were really informative interviews for me as well. And so I hope that you will keep listening, Kristen, and I hope to keep the good stuff coming your way. And with that, we better wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to me, shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can leave comments on our site about individual shows. You can leave voicemail on Skype where I'm ShrinkPod. You can use the MyChingo button. You can leave phone messages on 206-337-0622. And of course, you can participate in our Yahoo discussion group. You'll find a link to that on the Shrink Wrap Radio website. Thanks to my guest, Dr. Ann Weiser Cornell, for enlightening us about focusing. And my next show will feature Dr. Roger Kamenetz, who has worked with Mark Bregman from the recent Shrink Wrap Radio number 212. The History of Last Night's Dream, Discovering the Hidden Path to the Soul by Roger Kamenetz, was featured on Oprah Winfrey's Soul series. It's a fascinating interview that you won't want to miss. Please stay tuned after my sign-off for a few brief announcements with discounts for you. Until next time, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind. I want to thank our sponsor, Budget Car Rentals, for their support of Shrink Wrap Radio. May I suggest that you consider Budget.com for any of your automobile rental needs. Using my special code of SHRINK will get you or your family or friends that you share this information with $30 off weekly rentals or 10% off for other time periods. With Budget, you can rent like a genius. Next time you need someone to work on your home, repair your car, or fix your teeth, check Angie's List first. At Angie's List, you'll find thousands of unbiased ratings on hundreds of services. Just go to angieslist.com and use promo code SHRINK for 25% off your membership, or you can go to the Angie's List link on our site under the Promos tab for more information. Save money on your next car rental by going to avis.com/shrink. Avis tries harder with knowledge, caring, and a passion for excellence. You'll get 10% off or $30 off a weekly rental by going to avis.com/shrink or using the Avis link on our site at shrinkwrapradio.com.